Hey there, welcome back, and thank you for listening to Being Human is Weird. Today we have extraordinary guest, Dr. Natalie Nugent, PhD, LP, who has a background in trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, and resilience building. Dr. Natalie, will you please tell us more about yourself, about your background, what you've been focusing on, anything that you'd like for listeners to know?
Thank you, Abby. Thank you, Carrie. I am so glad to be here with you ladies and with listeners out there. I am super excited about the topic today, which is burnout and then moving into resiliency skill building. I have been working in the field of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder for a long time. I started my undergraduate career working in an anxiety and trauma disorders clinic, and I moved on to getting my master's and PhD in clinical psychology in the same field, really working to understand how our learning histories, our trauma exposure histories, our early childhood development, all of that coalesces to form who we are as people in the present moment. I am very, very passionate clinically about treating folks who have experienced trauma and who are experiencing subsequently post-traumatic stress disorder or other mental health conditions. I like to stay pretty busy in the field. In my day job, I am the chief operations officer for a community mental health agency. I work in public mental health, super passionate about that field. I feel like it's incredibly important that we recognize how vulnerable folks with serious and persistent mental illness are within our communities. And I feel like it's very, very important that we ensure that we have a robust public mental health system to serve folks who are suffering. I also, on the side, have a consulting practice. So I work with organizations, different healthcare settings, school districts, to health departments, to essentially talk about how folks have experienced trauma within their life, how they may be experiencing secondary traumatic stress as a result of the work that they do, particularly in serving other individuals, and the topic of burnout. Really understanding how we as humans have begun to experience increasingly distressing levels of occupational burnout, so much so that folks are leaving critically important fields. Folks are leaving education, folks are leaving healthcare, folks are leaving behavioral healthcare because they are feeling as though the demands of the job are too much for them to maintain. That is a little bit of what I bring to the table and why I'm so excited to talk about this topic with you all today.
Are fewer people going into the field as well, or are the rates of people leaving very high?
That's a really good question. I think that the rates of folks going into the field of psychology, my understanding, is pretty steady, but the level of need within our population is significantly increasing. So the percentage of folks who are experiencing mental health conditions and require treatment is huge. I am an adjunct lecturer for my alma mater, which is Eastern Michigan University, which was a nice full circle moment for me to be able to come back and teach classes for master's and PhD level students in clinical psychology. And one of the things that we really focus on is how can you understand the need that exists right now? What are the ways in which, you know, you can practice as a psychologist, because the opportunities are pretty endless in terms of what you can do? How are we going to serve the population through these various avenues, whether it's hospital work, private practice, community mental health, because we just simply, there aren't enough folks to be able to provide the care that's needed. And then we have conversations about the fact that we're having a nationwide mental health crisis.
So burnout is inevitable. I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's a horrible cycle.
It's a horrible cycle. And if you think about, so, you know, the definition of burnout is, I mean, very simply, it's a stress response. And it occurs when the amount that's being placed on you in terms of demand exceeds your capacity to meet that demand. So the founder and the key researcher on the in the field of burnout is Dr. Christina Maslach. She is incredible. Obviously, the amount of research that she has put into this topic and the amount of work and research that she's still doing is phenomenal and needed, you know, now probably as much as ever. You guys are probably familiar with the Stanford Prison Study. Does that sound familiar? Back in the early 1970s, Philip Zimbardo, did a research study where he essentially took college students and he broke them into corrections officers and then inmates and created a faux prison. And within days, it had gone off the rails. I mean, it was really atrocious. So Christina Maslach was actually Zimbardo's girlfriend at the time. And she was instrumental in halting the study. The way she tells it, they had a huge fight as she saw how the conditions were deteriorating and how awful things were becoming. And she just kind of put her foot down, right? And he did. He halted it after 6 days, which I think is pretty cool, right? Wow, and they're married, really cool. I assume, happily. And obviously he deferred to her, which that's cool.
Wow. Yeah, what a wow. Okay, talk about power couple. Sorry, Swifties, but this is...
We go back to Christina Maslach's burnout model. Essentially what she's getting at, it's a three-factor model. So we have emotional exhaustion, which we have all been there, right? Everybody has kind of woken up when the alarm goes off and you think, I cannot today. There's no way that I can go in and face that job. But then combined with that emotional exhaustion, there's this sense of decreased personal accomplishment. So you'll have that sensation of, I'm not getting anywhere. No matter what I do, I can't. Sometimes people will, you know, have that recurring thought, like maybe I'm not even cut out for this. Maybe I'm in the wrong field. And then you have what we call depersonalization. And that really becomes this sort of like cynical, detached version of yourself where you lose touch with the meaning in the work that you're doing. And you become a much more cynical version of yourself on the job. And if you think about from a behavioral healthcare or a healthcare practitioner standpoint, then that's pretty awful because essentially what it means is that a huge part of what we as healthcare providers are there to do is to provide support and empathy and compassion and to be present. And burnout kind of robs us of the ability to do those things.
Are those three things stages that you go through?
Yeah, that's so important. So interestingly enough, Dr. Maslach has this description of what she calls the overextended profile. So you may begin in this area where essentially you like your job, you know, you feel pretty good about your job, you enjoy the work that you're doing, but you're also simultaneously feeling like it's a struggle to keep up and that the work is starting to tax you in different ways. So she describes this as overextended, which is a precursor to then burnout. So then burnout really does encompass those three factors combined. So you will have some times where people will feel, you know, they're tired, they're fatigued, they need a break, but they maybe still have that sense of meaning associated with their job. They feel as though they're still doing a good job. But when you get those three factors together, that's when we start to see the picture of burnout.
And do you feel like the workplace is the only place that we can experience burnout, or is there other aspects of our life where burnout can happen?
I think we have all become much more in touch with the concept of burnout over the past several years, particularly with the effects of the pandemic and so many of the changes that occurred during the, you know, era of COVID, particularly with remote work, changes in childcare patterns. Burnout is really an occupational phenomenon. The World Health Organization actually recognized it as an occupational phenomenon in, I think it was 2019. I think we have to be cautious about extending it to other areas, but it definitely shows up in caregiving. So if we think about folks who are overextended in terms of parenting stress or aging parents that they're caring for, right? There are lots of ways in which we can begin to feel that sensation of burnout, although we still at its core really think about it from a work-related place.
That makes sense. I think of things like caregiving as a job or chores, constant chores. It's not like it's something where you can just quit.
Absolutely. And if we think about it as a stress response, that our body is being overly taxed by the demands that are being placed on it. Burnout itself is not a mental health condition, but it can absolutely exacerbate or lead to mental health conditions.
What are the best ways to recognize if I am in burnout, if a person is in burnout or approaching burnout? What are those common symptoms?
I love that, right? Because as a clinician and as a researcher, I'm always trying to think about how do we identify this problem before it's at its peak magnitude, because that's the issue, is that we want prevention first as opposed to total damage control once people have already left the field that they're in. So let me back up for a second and explain some of the other areas that impact burnout, because then I think that will help answer this question as well. We oftentimes think about burnout and workload, and people will say things like, there's too much work, I can't keep up with the work. But there are also other areas where there can start to be a mismatch that will then impact the overall sensation of burnout. So control is a big one. How much autonomy and personal control do you have in the workplace? Do you have the ability to make decisions, to enact change? Or are you really in a position where you are being told from 8 a.m. in the morning until 5 p.m. at night exactly how you will behave? Other dimensions include the sense of reward. Are you receiving, positive reinforcement? Are you receiving positive feedback? Do you feel intrinsically rewarded by the work that you do? Does it feel meaningful to you? Another component has to do with values. Do you feel like there's a sense of meaning and purpose in the work that you're doing? Because we can tolerate a whole lot of stuff if we feel as though we're living in line with our values and we're doing something in line with our purpose. Mm. So the question that you asked was, how do we start to know if we're either at risk for burnout or if we're starting to move into that phenomenon? And I think there are a few things. If we are consistently feeling overwhelmed and fatigued, and as though rest doesn't make it better, that's a concern. That's an emotional exhaustion component. If you're tired from a hard day's work and you go home and you rest and you sleep and you wake up in the morning and you feel like, okay, I can handle this, that's all right. But if each day feels like a struggle to tackle that next step and to show up at work, that's a red flag. The other thing is, if you feel as though the way you are experiencing your job is preventing you from feeling a sense of satisfaction at times, or a sense of living in line with those values that you hold. Fairness is another component that influences burnout. So do you kind of feel like things are distributed fairly at work? Do you feel as though you have fair opportunity for advancement at work? And if the answer is no, that's another risk factor. Addressing burnout is a relationship between the employee and the employer. There is no changing an employee through whatever technique, skill, coping response that you think, that is going to make an appreciable difference if we don't also have an employer and a workplace that is on board with supporting employee health and well-being. So what is really, really important about this topic is that we have to simultaneously support individuals in stress management, in resiliency building. And that's something I'm super passionate about, because resiliency is a skill, right? We think about it as a trait. You either are or you are not, but you can teach and learn resiliency skills, which is amazing, because we can strengthen folks, we can strengthen the resilience that folks are experiencing. But then if we think about the workplace, we have to have policies, practices, engagement, communication that support overall employee health. And an employer has to be willing to hear the employees if they are experiencing burnout and be willing to adjust and adapt based on the feedback that they're receiving. And that's really tricky. And I think we have learned, I hope, as a nation, that we can either, as employers, begin to shift the conversation and pay attention to what our employees are saying and make these workplace changes, or we can lose our workforce. We have two options. And I am in a position where, I think about this from two different perspectives, because on one hand, I'm a clinical psychologist, and sometimes the work that I'm doing feels very emotionally taxing and draining. And I think about it from a perspective of, how do I maintain my health and wellness in the field? Because I want to stay in this field. I feel very passionate about the work that I do. I also work as an administrator. So I'm a chief operations officer for a public health agency. So I also approach it from the standpoint of an administrator who hears folks coming in saying, I feel burned out, I feel as though I'm struggling. And we have to be willing to have that back and forth conversation, instead of saying, okay, work harder at being less burned out. We say, what can we do collaboratively to create culture in which burnout is less likely to occur?
Do you feel that the way your organization is handling it is the norm?
I think that the size of the organization or corporation is also really critical in this. It makes a huge difference. When you have large systems, you know, you think about it like, you know, those big freighter ships that you see out on open water. And if you want to, if you want that freighter ship to change course, it is a slow series of, you know, steady movements in the other direction, sometimes imperceptible to the eye, right? We're just gradually moving in a different direction. And I think that's very true of corporate change as well, that sometimes it can be very, very slow, painfully slow. And we lose employees during those change periods as well, because even if an organization comes to the table and says, I want to do things differently, there's going to be a time lag in when they can collect information, synthesize that information, and then put that into a change plan. One of the things that I do with my consulting practice on the side, I work with organizations. I work with other healthcare settings to really think about what are your folks experiencing from a perspective of burnout. And also, we do a lot of talk about secondary traumatic stress, because what folks are exposed to in healthcare settings oftentimes has the ability to create and produce that secondary traumatic stress. So we have to be willing to acknowledge that as well. Sometimes it's not just burnout. Sometimes it's another layer there. One of the things I try to always do is assume good intent. When somebody comes to me with a problem, I try to assume that they are bringing good intent to that. I think it's helpful to approach it from that perspective, as opposed to thinking that folks are maliciously making decisions to harm others. And I see that with organizations as well. Sometimes we're just doing a crappy job because we don't know how to do a better job.
Yeah. These are some very important points, and focusing what is within our control as an employee, because you're right, so much of this is based on the corporation or the employer, also listening to that individual. Can you walk us through a little bit about how we can start to build resiliency, knowing how important it is, not just for burnout, but for our lives?
Absolutely. I love this. I get super passionate about this topic because I am a huge positive psychology geek. I love the idea of thinking about all of the adaptive ways in which, you know, our brains and our bodies approach scenarios, approach stress. I think we've, you know, sort of done a disservice to the human mind by pathologizing a lot of what we do, when much of what we do is our body's way of trying to adapt to the scenarios that we're faced with. We just don't always adapt or respond in the healthiest of ways. Oftentimes that's because we don't know better. It's kind of like what we were talking about a moment ago. Here's the thing about resiliency. Resiliency essentially gets at our ability to adapt to stressful circumstances. So what we think about when we say that somebody is resilient is we're looking at this idea that an individual has been able to face adversity, hardship, stress, and they've been able to respond in a way that allows them to adapt to the situation while protecting their well-being. We can help people get to that point of healthy adaptation. There are some key components that go along with it. So one is something that we call cognitive flexibility. You guys think about it like this. Have you ever known someone or been the person who is just a concrete black and white thinker? It is either A or B, and there's no room in between.
90% of my family, but otherwise, no.
So other than those 90% that you're familiar with, right? When we think about cognitive flexibility, picture the opposite of that, right? And it's human nature. It is a tendency to think in black and whites, right? To think about this as A or B and nothing in between. But cognitive flexibility is a skill that really gets at our ability to do a couple things. Hold conflicting thoughts in our minds at the same time. So two things can be true at once, which is really hard for people to do, right? Really hard for people to do, but it's critical to our ability to think flexibly. The other thing that it involves is being able to perspective take as well. So how can we look at this scenario from multiple different places and vantage points? How can we really pay attention to our options, our choices? Because if we are stuck in a very concrete way of thinking, then we're much less likely to be able to explore all of the different avenues of choice that we have that can actually help with our resiliency. Cognitive flexibility is cool because we can actually teach that skill to people. We can encourage folks to first begin to bring awareness to their thought patterns. And you guys have probably heard the saying, right? Like, don't believe everything you think. Because the thing about our minds is that they are designed to think and to provide us with information, but they're not designed to provide us accurate factual information.
Yeah. Like, that would have been nice to know in my 20s.
Yeah. They're just generating a whole bunch of thoughts. And some of that stuff, we're lucky and it's true. And some of those things, you know, we're not so lucky and it probably is not so true. But man, oh man, we can hold tight to some of our most core beliefs. When we teach cognitive flexibility, we teach bringing awareness to thought patterns. We teach awareness of understanding connections among the thoughts that you have, the emotions that that generates, the behavior that that produces. And what's important about that, to tie it back into the field of burnout, is if I go to my job and I think to myself, I hate this place, I can't do this, I'm not even any good at my job, this is terrible, and I have sort of a running narrative in my mind about how bad, quote unquote, I am, my body will respond as though that is truth. My body doesn't know any different whether that's factual information or false information. And so I will trigger my stress response system in repeating those types of thoughts to myself. And now, let's say my employer really shows up to the table and they want to make some changes. I might not be at all in a place where I can even hear and respond to those changes because I am consistently sending myself a message that says, this place is dangerous. This place is bad for you. You are doing poorly here. So now my choices are narrowed for how I respond to the situation in front of me.
You mentioned cognitive flexibility and the skills that are involved in that. And we will get deep into other resiliency skills, how to practice, what to do in part two of this episode. And it kind of got me thinking about earlier when you mentioned that it's a relationship between the employee and the employer when there's burnout sprinkled in. Even if an employee is developing resiliency skills, what can someone do if they feel like their employer is not going to be receptive to this?
Yeah, this is a really, really complex topic because there are so many people who will come to the table and say, I really genuinely don't think that my employer is willing to make changes. I don't think they're willing to listen. I don't think I want to attend another pizza party. Right? Yeah, that's a classic example. We're struggling with burnout. Here's a pepperoni pizza. Mm-hmm. I hope you feel better, right? Here's my thought on that from a clinician's perspective, from a consultant's perspective, from a researcher's perspective. We need to first be sure that our employer is not willing to come to the table. And we can only do that if we open up the conversation and the dialogue. And there is momentum behind this movement. Because so many healthcare professionals across the board in terms of the different sectors are experiencing burnout. And we haven't even begun to talk about the educational sector and teachers and paraprofessionals and all of the support staff who are working within the education system. Our levels of burnout, occupational burnout, are extreme. And as folks leave the workforce, our employers are being forced to reckon with this. So first I say, we need to be sure that the conversation's off the table. The second thing we need to do is we really need to understand what is our relationship to the job that we're doing. Is it a job that you're marking time in and it means nothing to you and you can't wait for the next thing to come along? That's a different conversation, right? We might talk about the fact that maybe your mental health is not worth the risk of sticking it out in a position that you don't feel connected to in any way. But if you are working in a field that you really feel passionate about, that you really enjoy or love, or worked for years to get into, you know, think about all the time and energy that goes into getting an education in a particular field that you care about, getting licensed if you need to, hired, then we really need to think about, what about this career feels meaningful to me? What am I willing to tolerate in terms of work-related stress? Because all jobs have stress, in the service of still living in line with this work-related value. The other thing we need to talk about is, what kind of boundaries do we need to set for ourselves? It is possible that when we take a step back and when we look at, what sort of energy am I putting in? What sort of return am I getting on that energy? There may be areas in which we can set harder boundaries. We may be able to offload certain tasks. We may be able to set firm lines in when I accept phone calls and emails, when I put in that extra time. COVID really blurred the lines for people working at work and working at home. And many of us are still working in hybrid settings. So we automatically have looser, grayer boundaries. Now we think about, you know, is the organization willing to come to the table? Are we willing to set specific boundaries? Do we care about this job enough to want to work on this? The good question becomes, what do we need to do to support our own stress response? If we think about occupational burnout as a stress response, then there are healthier, more effective ways to manage your stress response, and then there are more maladaptive ways to manage it. And so then that becomes a conversation about, okay, what can I do as a person to manage how I respond to the stress of this job if I've chosen to stay in it? And sometimes you just ask yourself, do I care about this job? And if the answer is yes, okay, am I willing to stick it out? If the answer is yes, what am I willing to do to change in the interest of preserving my health?
What if the answer is no?
Leave.
How do you get yourself to take that step? Because then it becomes, well, I don't have money, I have kids, I blah, blah, blah. You know, mental health takes a backseat in those instances.
Yeah. So you'll either pay for it up front or you'll pay for it later. You know,
that's what I was going to ask, is if you choose to do nothing, what are the long-term effects of burnout? Good if you question. Just head down, muscle through for the next 40 years of your life.
Yeah, you're going to end up miserable in a lot of different ways. So we know that there are risks associated with burnout from both a physical health perspective, and we know that there are risks associated from a behavioral health perspective. You know, sleep disturbances, anxiety disorders, depressive symptoms. We also know that there is increased risk for cardiovascular disease, for metabolic disorders, for diabetes risk, obesity, right? All the stuff that we know is connected up with maladaptive stress responses. So the cost, you know, the potential stakes are really high. And what's interesting is that people can work in really hard, hard, hard professions for decades and do really well. But there are certain contextual factors that have to be present. One, I mean, the body needs rest. We as human beings must have rest. We have to have physical rest, and we have to have emotional and cognitive rest. We cannot be on 24/7. That is a challenge, because most of us function now in workplaces in which there is an expectation that people will be on almost anytime they're needed. But we don't have to be. And that's really interesting. And sometimes I will say that, especially to newer clinicians that I'm working with. Okay, so set the boundary. What's the worst that's going to happen? And a lot of times what you hear is catastrophizing, which gets back into those cognitive errors, right? And that, you know, that worst case scenario, and it's going to absolutely be the worst outcome, as opposed to, what if it's a gray area? Right? What if it is hard to set the boundary, but the boundary ends up helping you? You know, what if it ends up being able to sustain you and prolong your longevity?
Why do people imagine worst case scenario instead of immediately going to the gray area? Is it a safety thing, a control thing?
It's both. It is so adaptive from an evolutionary perspective to think about the potential worst case scenario. If I can plan for and predict danger, risk, worst case outcome, then in my head, I'm convincing myself that this keeps me safer. The more I prepare for the worst outcome, the more I feel as though I have control over that outcome, which is an illusion, because a lot of what occurs in our life is unpredictable and is up to chance. And that's terrifying. And so if you're an overthinker, which I myself and I'm a proud overthinker, that's right. So many people are nodding along, right? As an overthinker, then it's my job to remind myself what I'm doing cognitively. That once again, this is my mind doing what minds do. It's giving me a whole bunch of thoughts. It's giving me a whole bunch of outcomes. It does not mean those are factual and that they will occur as I've thought them in my mind. If we stop thinking about resiliency as a trait and we stop thinking about it as something that people are either born with or they just miss out, right? And you're like, oh, you're just not resilient. Sorry about that. Then we lose sight of the fact that we have a wealth of tools available to us to actually enhance our one stress response and two, our resiliency building skills, which again, really get down to our ability to adapt. That's what we're working on here. How can we become better adapters? And human beings, I mean, we exist now because we're good at adapting, right? We wouldn't exist as a species without our ability to adapt to all of the different stressors that have been thrown our way. So this is just a new frontier, right? We're adapting to a new type of workplace setting, and we can do that. We just have to have skills, community, teamwork, and a mutual understanding that this is for the betterment of all of us.
And building those skills heightens your own strengths and capabilities to the point that when you catastrophize, you also, okay, I've been here before. I know that whatever comes my way, I am capable, I am resilient of rolling with it. So there is a negative feedback loop. There's a positive feedback loop.
Neurons that fire together, wire together. Right. And I use this all of the time in my clinical practice. We are going to create those neural pathways one way or another.
Thank you so much, Dr. Natalie. We have learned an immense amount of important information from you today. And I'm so excited to have you back next week so that we can continue this conversation specifically around resiliency skills and how to build those and the community and everything that I know we're going to cover next time. Please let our listeners know how they can find and follow you and learn more about the good work that you're doing.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me. I could talk about this stuff all day. It is my passion, and I love the idea of building community around this topic because resilience requires community. We have to do this in a communal team setting. We cannot do this in isolation. You can find me on Instagram at Lake Huron Wellness or at my website, www.lakehuronwellnessconsulting.com.
If you are with us and believing being human is weird, then like, subscribe, share, all of those things that the kids are doing, and be sure to follow us on Instagram at Being Human is Weird. That's where we're going to be sharing resources, inspiration, and news about our podcast.
And we would love to hear from you, so slide right into our DMs with questions, comments, and what you'd like to hear more of. And thank you so much for listening, Weirdos.